History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. During the millennia of humanity's existence, nothing has shaped us more, arguably, than the city. From their beginning, cities diversified human endeavor. We went from hunting and foraging and maybe some agricultural work to new professions, creating art, new forms of worship, new forms of trade, which kickstarted civilization. Today's guest, Ben Wilson, author of the book Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention, talks about how urban living has allowed human culture to flourish. They created civics in the Agora of Athens, global trade in 9th century Baghdad, finance in the coffeehouses of London, fashion in Belle Epoque France, and in the modern age, the skyscrapers of New York City inspired utopian visions of community design, while the trees of 21st century Seattle and Shanghai point to the possibility of sustainability in the future. We also talk about things like city walls, which don't seem important unless you're really into medieval warfare, were actually one of the most important things a civilization could have until the modern age. City walls allowed cities to be islands of peace in an ocean of poverty and violence. And when Paris brought down its city walls in the 16th century, it was sort of signaling to the world how powerful France was. Plus, we look at utopian cities like the Jetsons and compare them to dystopian cities like Fritz Lang's Metropolis or Blade Runner. And finally, talking about 21st century tensions between cities and rural areas when it comes to things like pollution, gun control, and how the tension can eventually be resolved. So we're looking at thousands of years and a couple of dozen different metropoli. And I think this is a really useful framework to understand history and how rural areas and cities were fundamentally very different in the past up until recent centuries. And this tension explains a lot of the conflict that we still have today. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Ben Wilson. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, cities are obviously very important, and what you're doing is providing a through line to connect different metropoli from around the world and around history and zero in on their unique significance. There's been very interesting archaeological discoveries that I think have reshaped our understanding of the past and what caused human settlements to converge. We used to assume that when agriculture developed, then villages, towns, cities evolved, but then with new things like Göbekli Tepe show sites of worship from far further in the past than we ever expected. This is something that's always evolving, but from the vantage point of your book, when does the first city proper develop?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, you make fantastic points there about that kind of changing kind of landscape of archaeology. The first city that I kind of see is fulfilling the criteria for the beginnings of urbanization, as we understand it, was Uruk, which is a city in southern Mesopotamia in modern-day Iraq. There were sizable settlements before, for sure, but Uruk was of a different kind of scale, density, and different functions. And you're right that there was a sort of idea of a kind of linear development of cities. I think that modern archaeology, and certainly the way I approach it in the book, is to break down that idea of linearity, going from agriculture spawning farms, small settlements, villages leading to towns, leading to cities. Uruk and the other cities that form in Mesopotamia form in the marshes. And that's very similar for other places where urbanism started independently. So in San Lorenzo, in Central America, in the Niger Delta, these are all creations of wetlands, of marshes, places where there's a kind of intersection of sea, land, fresh water, brackish water, desert, but also very fertile areas, which provides a kind of superabundance of resources, but also a very shifting terrain. So these are fantastic places to live, to harness their biodiversity, but very difficult places to settle and farm. They also, Uruk, well, the settlement that came before Uruk seems to have been built on a kind of marshy island in this very shifting terrain where floods can change the landscape. Building something permanent in this volatile landscape seems to be the kind of preconditions for the development of a city afterwards. There were places of worship. There were sort of places almost as the Mesopotamians saw it, where the world began, you know, this place of kind of religious significance, often around sources of fresh water. So to build these sort of platforms, temples, the houses of the gods, this started, you know, put a marker of something permanent in this shifting terrain. And people needed to serve the gods. They were freed up from the needs of subsistence agriculture by the resources of these sort of Deltic estuary areas, the marshes, kind of provide this, you know, these resources to build. And there's a kind of ideology. What lies behind urbanization is that idea of permanence. So it seems to be really interesting that they come out of these marshy environments rather than kind of settled agricultural areas. And places like, you know, Western Europe don't get cities for millennia, despite having farms and all the kind of things you might see as preconditions for urbanization. It comes from this particular place at a particular time of people coming together from all across what we call the Fertile Crescent, where the agriculture begins, bringing new ideas about settlement to this very radical new thing, the city. Uruk means city. It was this thing, and it was they believed the underpinning this ideology was that their gods were urban dwellers. They wanted to live in cities, so to live with the gods in their city and to benefit from all the things that came from early urbanization, better quality of life, an engineered microclimate in a very hot place. They engineered, you know, narrow streets, shade that harnessed breezes and winds. They were able to develop that kind of clustering of people together in high density areas. It meant a very quick transmission of knowledge and information. It was called the Smithy of the Gods, or a place of where craft and art was designed, a place where trade begins, of monumental architecture. So this was an exciting place to live. It was constantly being built and rebuilt. And then you get over the course of hundreds of years, but in the timescales of anything that preceded it, lightning quick developments. To manage the complexities of living in the city, you have to be able to record and write. You have to manage transactions. So the Uruk is where the written word is first developed as a way of recording transactions. It later morphs into literature. First major work of literature in human history, the epic Gilgamesh, comes from Uruk and is almost about Uruk. There's the beginnings of money and transactions, long-distance trade, because it's a very resource-poor area in terms of building materials and precious metals. They had to trade. They had to trade their abundance of food and beer for precious metals and jewels and things like that. And then it starts this trade. It starts new cities. So you get a very fast series of changes in the ways that humans live, the way that humans settle, because of this kind of dynamic urban environment. I don't want to make this sound like a paradise, but it also brings in its train, in this complex hierarchical society, the beginnings of enslavement and slavery, of organized warfare, hierarchies, bureaucracies, tyranny. All these big changes that are consequential in human history begin in places like Uruk, these sort of mushrooming cities that develop in this area and spread the idea of urbanization. You know, it's an incredible kind of series of things that happen and come out, as I say, come out of these particular environments, it seems to me, not just in Mesopotamia, but globally, that there seems to be a sort of place almost where things are propitious for urbanization, but it's the challenge of that landscape, not its kind of ease. It's an interesting kind of, to me, it was interesting to work to see that there was a sort of precondition for the beginnings of cities, and it wasn't kind of what you would expect it to be. It wasn't an abundance of crops or easy living. It was an operating in a harsh but also almost spiritual terrain that people invested meaning in, but also it gave them life and the ability to settle like that.
Among the smart set, it seems like cities and the entire agricultural revolution has been called into question last decade, especially the Yuval Harari book, Sapiens, that without getting into relitigating that entire book, there are a lot of interesting things about it. It's a fun read, but it sure makes it sound like there was a Garden of Eden state for humanity. But with the agricultural revolution and settlements, then class structures developed that isn't as amenable to the natural human condition as being a hunter-gatherer is. But what I find interesting in these early millennia of city developments, you mentioned Uruk and then other cities I'd love you to talk about, of Babylon, Harappo, and other things too, is that there's a kind of creative destruction, a lot of different models being tried out. Another archaeological ruin in Anatolia is Çatalhöyük. It looks like a beehive, just these little settlements tied together and then layer upon layer upon layer, where they seem to be burying the previous settlements. Just very odd and not at all how we find modern cities. So these older civilizations and these archaeological sites that they found in, what are some of the interesting things that you see too in these early millennia of cities, and they're training out these new models?
Well, I mean, there's constant experimentation. And I think, you know, to your point about the city being an unnatural place for us to live, the Mesopotamians were very aware of that. I mean, I base a lot of the first chapter around the Epic of Gilgamesh, where there is this tension between the Gilgamesh was this half-divine king ruler of Uruk, but he finds city living quite a strain. You know, he doesn't see it as natural, and he kind of rebels against it. He becomes a bit of a nuisance to his people because he's kind of full of these kind of elemental energies. So the gods send to him a kind of wild man to tame him, Enkidu, this sort of barbarian figure who's seduced to the city, like a lot of people through history, by sex, but also by alcohol, by the kind of noise and clamor and excitement of the city. And they become friends, Gilgamesh and Enkidu. But Enkidu gets killed. Gilgamesh rejects the city and goes to look for immortality, leaves the city, goes to the ends of the world to try and find a better way, or to try and find immortality. He rejects the city. But in the end, he's told by the kind of Noah figure of the Sumerian belief system that he can never have immortality. And he goes back to Uruk and he says, well, this is immortality. This is how the epic ends. This is immortality. Look at the walls around the city. Look at the written word. This is how we achieve immortality. So there's a real strain there between this kind of idea of a more primitive lifestyle, what is good for us. But I mean, the Sumerians kind of answered that by saying that cities define themselves against other people, that look at the progress that we are, look at the artifacts of civilization. There's a very sharp division. Although the city, admittedly, as they admit is in the Epic of Gilgamesh, is a challenge for us, for sure. You know, overall, it brings these incredible benefits, not least the written word, not least kind of, a kind of feeling of immortality and permanence and the beginnings of recorded history, really. A kind of contrast to those warlike, constantly fighting Mesopotamian cities, my kind of sort of the kind of utopian sort of alternative to that archaeologists found is Harappa in the Indus Valley in modern day Pakistan. The cities that we barely kind of understand because, you know, the knowledge of it is small, but these were kind of highly engineered cities based around the monsoon, about harvesting water. And the archaeologists find it remarkable and maybe slightly eerie that there's no signs of warfare or much social hierarchy, lots of toys. It was a kind of playful place. They're the things that people find, and a kind of sanitation systems that are way ahead of their time. It's almost like it's a kind of Garden of Eden city environment, that they did something wrong that other urban cultures didn't. I mean, I find that strange that people could live, you know, so peacefully and without the need of slaves and things like that. It seems very unusual. Maybe we don't know enough about it, but certainly there is through history a kind of idea that if we get cities right, then we're better people. You know, there's a sort of idea that cities corrupt us, but within them is a kind of idea of their own regeneration. I mean, look at the powers that the cities give us. Look at what, you know, that can go wrong, but it's a worthwhile bargain to make. The bargain that Enkidu and Gilgamesh made with the city is a worthwhile bargain because it means power, it means permanence, it means something divine as well. It means that people have always tried to, the early societies have always tried to design cities around the movements of the stars, cardinal points, almost like they're replicating in a very chaotic world the kind of divine plan. There's something divine about cities. That's the kind of where their power derives from. You look at the alternative, the Bible, the Old Testament has very bad things to say about the city. It picks up on that side of cities, the cities are the place that incubate vices, that bring slavery. And because comes from a very particular time, it's the time when the Jews were taken in captivity to Babylon, and they looked and they saw this as a punishment. They were taken to this huge city, the kind of successor cities to Uruk and Ur and some of the other Mesopotamian cities. They were taken in captivity to this huge, spectacular, biggest city in the world, and saw only vice and saw only punishment, their punishment for their own sins to be taken there. So if you think about the Bible, Judeo-Christian tradition sees the beginnings, that sees kind of our fall is from a garden, whereas the Mesopotamians and other urban cultures see cities as places, the gifts from the god. There's a tension that runs through history that's kind of that cities are things that pervert us, make us go wrong, do bad things. But the, you know, the Bible ends in a celestial city. It ends in a kind of, you know, Jerusalem as this kind of perfected city. And as I tell this story of urbanization, the good and the dark side of cities, is that throughout, you know, there's this pull in our natures between seeing cities as, yeah, good for us on the kind of macro, good for our species in terms of augmenting and collecting power and collective knowledge and passing that knowledge down. Like, cities are data processing places as much as they are anything else. They encode knowledge and pass it down. But there's also this feeling that we shouldn't be there, that this is wrong. You find that, you know, that the Old Testament is full of sort of fantasy stories of destroying these sinful cities. But if you design them right, you'll get them right. You know, the Greeks had that. The cities could be more like Harappa, this Indus Valley civilization, if only we knew how to design them right. I mean, that's a kind of fantasy in a way, because cities are kind of incrementally built. They reflect our vices as much as our virtues. And they, you know, they bring early death and disease as much as they bring a kind of, you know, a collective power, which has always been their kind of their draw and their excitement. They bring the kind of the vice of kind of freedom, but also the moralists look on in despair. But for other people, that is freedom. So those tensions are really kind of picked up in all these early kind of cultures that urbanize, in the stories of these big kind of monstrous cities that develop things like, you know, the Tower of Babel or the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, that they have a kind of awesome majesty, but also a kind of dark and dangerous and perverting side. And I think in those old stories, in the archaeological record, in our kind of view of them through history as places of magnificence and sort of, you know, overwhelming, you know, grandeur, but also places that, you know, that were brutal places to live in.
That's an interesting tension you point out, that changes throughout history and in different civilizations on the emphasis of city versus rural life, where it seems as a civilization or a nation state is growing on the development curve, they really look towards cities proudly as this is a place of innovation, whereas the backwards ideas that are holding back our development are mostly to blame on rural civilizations. I think of China now, that is all of its development. And when it promotes itself and showcases itself on international stages, it's always showing its cities. Whereas a nation that has sort of passed the curve and is maybe higher up and is suffering from urban tensions looks fondly on its rural life, that this is the where the true civilization, the hinterlands, where the true culture lives on, real America or whatnot.
Yeah.
And to kind of explore that tension that's interesting, and some of the cities that you talk about specifically in your book, the concepts of democracy that we have came from the classical world in the Greek city-states and also Rome. The electoral college that we have comes from Rome. Athenian democracy and civic participation comes from these places. And Thomas Jefferson, for example, alludes frequently, many times in the other founding fathers, to these ideas, but then he has a vision of a democracy that is of the Yao man, that where the primacy is on local government and a mainly agricultural national economy, which doesn't happen. But so he loves the rural idea of government, even though his ideas come from cities. So can you talk about the development of basically all of our ideas that guide democracy today coming from these urban centers in the ancient world?
Yeah, I mean, it's very particular. I mean, I think the idea of kind of Greek city, the Greek polis, the kind of where we derive a lot of these ideas of our, you know, politics, comes from the Mesopotamia in a way that the cities of the Levant, the Phoenician cities, are kind of offshoots of this urban culture, very sort of distantly over millennia, and they spread the kind of, you know, they seed the idea of cities into the Mediterranean. What the Greeks do, what the Greek polis, how that differs from other ancient civilizations, is the idea of public space. The center of the Greek polis was the agora, you know, the marketplace. It means buying and selling, but it was a place of an exchange the enactment of political public life amongst adult male citizens. This was a place where the community could come together, you know, and as they said of the Greek agora, it was a place where you could buy figs, buy vegetables, buy olive oil, buy wine, talk about your neighbor's adulteries, serve as a juror, talk about politics, all these functions would jumble together in a very kind of dynamic environment. And in Athens, the Agora was designed as a kind of, you know, it was purposely designed as a celebration of democracy. When Athens made the move towards democracy, there was a revolution in the idea of public space. And public space, I think, is that implanted the idea of some kind of public space at the right at the heart of what it is, you know, what a city should be, is to have these places of political meeting and exchange. They were also, those Greek cities were more cosmopolitan than cities had been before, I think. Well, they were cosmopolitan in their own kind of terms. And they were open to a kind of porous interchange of ideas between Asia, between the societies that the Greeks kind of interacted with on their fringes and were sort of transmitted across the Greek world. And it was in the kind of the back streets of Athens and the immigrant districts that Socrates gets a lot of his sort of ideas about talking to people who are crisscrossing the Greek world. It's not in the kind of marbled halls, the sort of splendor of those buildings. But nonetheless, it's in that kind of jumble, that exchange of ideas in the Greek world, that sort of ideas about talking and discussion. Athens was a place of perpetual conversation, it seems. You know, the Greek philosophers, the early ones, didn't necessarily write things down. It was, everything was done sort of in a public face-to-face kind of culture. And that sort of idea, you know, encoded in the polis, you know, in this sort of self-governing, tight, face-to-face society where adult males could, exchange ideas and run, be independent. The independence of the polis was bound up with your independence as a male citizen was important. And that was kind of what gave the city the strength. Its strength was this kind of, you know, was this the vitality of that face-to-face culture. Similarly, I mean, this was an urban phenomenon. The Greeks, the idea of being, of polis, of being, you know, of politics, of self-government was bound up with the idea of the city, almost with the topography of the city, that these public and sacred spaces all interacted together to create a kind of a world that made politics possible, was possible only in an urban environment. If you were Greek, you know, to be civilized, to be free, to be part of a political culture was specifically to be urban, I think. But the Romans have a slightly different take on it. They have this sort of nostalgic look to the Arcadian past, you know, although they are fearsomely urban in their kind of, in the way that their empire is constructed and this spread of an urban form that's based around politics and pleasure, around the forums, but also around bathhouses and amphitheaters and theatres and, you know, the things that cater to the things that make city life pleasurable were also bound up with a notion of politics, that the giving a gift, the making a big city like Rome, a mega city of a million people livable for its citizens, was based not just around its kind of public spaces and public monuments and architecture. It was also based around the gifts of the elite in the Republic, the politicians giving bathhouses or theatres, or places of mass entertainment, was bound up also with public life as well. So you have that, an interesting interaction and a kind of evolution of that kind of that idea of public life as it was developed in the Greek world. And I think, you know, they're very much, you know, that kind of urban ideal has characterized right through the Middle Ages and the self-governing city-states of Europe, that cities are a place where you can be free, where people are given a freedom away from feudal or unstable kind of warring areas. Was a place where you could break free of that and live a life that was more independent. You know, the city kind of protected and nurtured that kind of political involvement.
Something interesting too, I mean, jumping to cities that focus on global trade, is that if we talk about planned cities, most would imagine that for something like that to be possible, you need urban planners and modern sciences along those lines. But planned cities are absolutely nothing new. And many of the cities that we imagine existed far back into antiquity and go date to the ancient world, like London, some of them actually have much more modern origins, such as Baghdad, which is created to serve a very specific function. So how did its planning and creation come about, and how did it become this global hub of trade?
Well, Baghdad is fascinating, and it's a sort of inheritor of, you know, of millennia. I mean, it's situated in the cradle of urban civilization in Iraq. It's the sort of successor city to Rome in a way, as a kind of a colossal city. It was planned to be a kind of round city. Fascinatingly, it was supposed to sort of represent a crossroads of the world, the kind of the center of the world. And it was that sort of that idea of centrality. It was the capital city of the caliphs, the center of the Islamic empire, that kind of had this sort of global power very quickly. And Baghdad was the city of cities. In the early Islamic Empire was a very urban culture, inherited a lot of cities from the fallen Roman Empire. But Baghdad sort of shifted that move further east. It was had a sacred center, a sacred and imperial center, ringed by the homes and places of the elite, and then a sort of sprawling suburbs on the outside. But the roads led off, you know, from this center to the distant corners of the Islamic world, to Egypt, to the Mediterranean, south to Mecca and Medina, Central Asia. So it was built to be a place that was a linchpin that would attract, because it had the tax wealth of the Islamic world. It could also draw into its orbit the trade routes of the world that extended as far as China. There was words put into the early caliph's mouth that said, you know, now we've built a city on the Euphrates, you know, we will have a trade link straight to China, which is remarkable. And I sort of tell that story of Baghdad by looking at a shipwreck in the Java Sea, the Belitung shipwreck that was discovered 20 or so years ago, that had these amazing, if you go to the Museum of Asian History in Singapore, you see these bowls. It's almost like walking into the museum gift shop. They look that new and sparkly. They found 55,000 of these bowls, these mass-produced items in China that were on their way on a dhow to Baghdad to be sold in the markets of Baghdad, along with the spices and other things they picked up along the way on this immense trading route that linked the Chinese cities with Baghdad and the urban culture of Islam. It was a crossroads of that trade. It was a place that was characterized by its street food, actually. It was a place where people came. It was a place that drew in migrants from all over the world, from lots of different religious backgrounds, not just Islamic. There was big Jewish and Christian populations. There was some evidence of Chinese populations. They all, you know, people bought food. There was a taste for exotics and novelties coming from thousands of miles away. Caliphs, it was said, would don the disguise of a common person and go into the street to eat the street food. You know, forget hipsters now. There was this kind of vibrant sort of street food kind of culture going on in Baghdad. And not surprisingly, because it linked so many places in the world, but it also linked that knowledge, right? It was a crossroads of knowledge. It drew from the Mediterranean traditions of the Greeks and the Romans. It drew from the really kind of important intellectual powerhouses of Central Asia, places that are kind of forgotten now. Seems like Merv, Bukhara, that were themselves places that drew knowledge from China and India, bringing those ideas of mathematics, Greek philosophy, blending those ideas together, much like kind of Baghdad blended cuisine from around the world and different commodities. It blended this knowledge as well. I mean, that was this sort of awesome sort of example of a city, a planned city, that was planned, not just planned on the latest kind of ideas of urban life, but also on ways to harness and draw in trade, to use technology. This was where paper was brought from China, and they had a huge paper industry, fueled partly by the demand for cookbooks, because it was such a kind of gastronomic culture. But it also, that was another way of encoding knowledge, a revolutionary way of encoding knowledge, and found on the shipwreck were ink pots. So saying that, you know, that these things were now becoming commodities for people, you know, there was a way, it was part of this kind of, you know, intellectual kind of effervescence, as much as it was of a kind of, you know, a statement city, that the statement that this was the city, this was the center of the world, metaphorically, of course. I mean, nowhere's the center of the world, but it kind of literally was as well, because it was the linking between the cultures of the world, the kind of beginnings almost of a global city before in the pre-Columbian age. It was a sort of a city of a network of cities of which it sat at the center and was able to kind of control and draw the best people and ideas and commodities and goods and foods from.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
It's too bad that the Mongols destroyed some of those cities that you specifically mentioned, like Merv and other of these cosmopolitan hubs along the Silk Road. That Merv is in Turkmenistan, modern-day Turkmenistan, if I have that right.
Yeah.
So some of the most wealthy, most glorious cities of sort of the early part of the Middle Ages, which Europe, there's very little going on. And when major armies go through major areas and conquer, and they plunder and pillage an area, sometimes a city can be so utterly destroyed that it simply isn't worth rebuilding. So we lose a sense of scale on the ancient world, that if Merv were better preserved like a Rome, then I think that would really change our idea. Before jumping into the modern age, I actually want to discuss something specifically along those lines. That's city walls, which for those that don't know much about their importance, they might hear that and think, okay, that sounds like a niche area of military history, but walls are very, very important from the past. In the Old Testament, there are a couple of books that specifically have to do with the rebuilding of Jerusalem city walls. A few years ago, some archaeologists or classicists had fun where they submitted a paper called Making Sumeria Great Again, all about a treaty in which Sumeria would get Akkadia to pay for its own city walls, you know, riffing on the Donald Trump campaign promises of 2016. But Constantinople, I think I've had an entire podcast episode about the Theodosian city walls, that Constantinople became such an important city and developed so much, and it became rich because it simply wasn't conquered for an incredibly long period of time because its city walls made it nearly impossible. So when I think about city walls, it's sort of like cities are these islands of wealth in oceans of rural poverty.
Yeah,
that's what I think of when I think of city walls, that there's no national police force or military or national guard that's providing general tranquility and security. It's a fortress of security in seas of banditry and lawlessness and outlaw and that type of scape. Do I have that right when I think of cities in the pre-modern period?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends where you are in a way in the world. European cities certainly, if we're going to the Middle Ages, and if we compare them to the other kind of powerhouse cities of the world, or the powerhouse cities of the world when Europe was a rather obscure backwater, especially as far as urbanization was concerned. I mean, city walls they're a fascinating topic. You could talk about them in so many different reasons. I think when I'm talking about the kind of the Indian Ocean civilization cities that were where kind of the urban center of gravity was in the early Middle Ages, they were cities without walls. They were very peaceful, free trading cities, and had a very expansive form of urbanization. They were almost like cities in forests. Whereas in a more warlike Europe, cities like the ones I concentrate on, like Lübeck in North Germany, were these islands of stability and freedom and free trade. And they were set up very specific. They were the product of war. So a city like Lübeck, which was one of the sort of the major cities of Europe in the Middle Ages, was the creation of the Crusades, but the Northern Crusades, not the Crusades of the Holy Land, the Crusades against the pagan Slavs in the Baltic region. So they were created by, these cities were created by supply depots, as marketplaces, by rulers who were going on crusade. The quid pro quo was that they got an element of freedom and autonomy, and they became very secure behind their city walls. It's very small, compact European cities behind city walls especially in Northern Europe, less so in England, where there was more of a sort of centralized, powerful monarchy. But certainly in Europe, they were places where there were places, where, you know, the saying in Germany was that city air makes you free. If you could live in a city for a year, you became free of feudal obligations. So in Europe, the development of cities and the development of militaries and warfare, military technologies are so bound together that we get a kind of the perpetual kind of competition between cities. Cities like Lübeck, which were based around a free Baltic, free trading, moving of mass commodities like herring and salt and grain and beer and English cloth and woolens, the big kind of important commodities of the time, were also not just sort of nice free trading things like the first version of the EU. They also had their own private armies and needed their defense. If you look at any of these cities from the sky or an aerial picture, they were protected behind these constantly changing bastions. The walls always change, right? They're the one part of the city that constantly has to keep up with military technology. And cities were almost, you know, before the invention of gunpowder, cities that had strong walls were almost impregnable, almost. They could certainly hold out for many years, and they were almost not worth fighting for until technology advanced, or you were like the Mongols and you could simply kind of use a mixture of technology and just manpower to knock cities over. But cities that stood behind walls were more important. It's amazing to me to think that the mayors of Lübeck were at certain points of their history more powerful than the kings of England and could hold England to ransom, these relatively small cities that were kind of at the forefront of developing military technologies, especially at sea, but also, you know, their kind of primary unit, the city itself, surrounded by walls. There's a great, I mean, I could talk about walls all day. I mean, they're kind of, there's even a kind of ecology of walls, that they kind of have a particular ecology. They have certain types of plants. But that, suffice to say that as the kind of, there's a kind of competition in Europe between gunpowder and city walls, and a development of how you can make your bastions stronger. You have star formations, bigger fortresses, bloodier and more kind of involved, you know, multi-year kind of events of besieging cities. And they become strategic kind of goals of warfare, especially in the 15th and 16th centuries. Of course, Paris, when it pulls down its walls in the 16th century, it does it because it says we're now invincible. France is such a huge military power that taking down the city walls was a symbolic act. The Dutch word for the things was boulevard, which is where we get the word boulevard. So when Paris's walls were pulled down, they were turned into walkways, boulevards. That's where we get this kind of, there's a whole sort of influence of city walls on subsequent urbanism, that the cities, the walls that ring cities, especially in Europe and especially in Germany and Austria and places like that, when they were taken down, they become these kind of green areas around the city that demarcate the dense historic urban core from the suburbs and retain that idea of the central city, that it doesn't sort of pancake outwards like a lot of other places. And the, you know, as I say, the idea of boulevards and sort of, extramural kind of architecture and things like that get bound up into cities. So they have a really interesting history, city walls. But I think from the point of view of the development of the Middle Ages, that the military, one of the reasons why Europe becomes so kind of outclasses any other region in the world in terms of its military technology is because you have hundreds or thousands of very small units of city-states that are able to, they're in a very strong competition with each other to retain their independence, retain their economic superiority. And it's only with the rise of the subsequent rise and much later rise of the nation state that you see that kind of end of that idea of the primacy of cities. But the sort of, economic and military development is very, very closely bound up with cities and cities as this kind of leader of technology. So when, a city, a relatively obscure European city like Lisbon kind of goes into the Indian Ocean and encounters other cities that have relied on free trade and cosmopolitanism and a lack of warfare, this obscure, very poor kind of European city is able to have a disproportionate amount of power over cities that were much bigger, immeasurably wealthier than them, like Calicut in India, Malacca and the Straits of Malacca near present-day Singapore, and served a similar function to Singapore as a crossroads of trade. Immense wealth, but could be kind of knocked over by Europeans coming from this much more competitive kind of environment and people who had honed their warfare skills in siege and counter-siege.
Well, you raise a lot of really good points there. And I think in general, for people to understand the past, these are great things to keep in mind that many people dismiss, which is, in many ways, seas are islands of security in an ocean of instability. And for most of history, from the Middle Ages backward, essentially, unless you're in rare points where there's a very powerful empire that controls things, Rome at the height of its power, the Mongolian Empire at the height of its power, where Marco Polo can essentially travel across it unmolested with a steel from the Great Khan saying that he's offered security. Really, I mean, going from city to city, it's a lot like going to rural Afghanistan, that there's highwaymen, you have to be armed, it can be very dangerous. Yes, there may be pilgrimage routes or other things where there's a little bit more protection, but like you said, when France takes down its walls, it's sort of like the security of the city is spread outward throughout the rest of the nation as a sign of its overall wealth and prosperity, so that the function of a city changes. So I'd like to jump up into the modern period and talk about the idea of the city. And again, I mean, there's very contrasting views. One idea I like, I like the Golden Age science fiction, the World's Fair, City of Tomorrow type of futuristic idea, which in its positive way produced things like Seattle Space Needle, going up to the atomic age of the 1960s, where General Electric would put up promotional videos of tomorrow in the future, you will take a cable car from your office to your home, and the Jetsons, and this type of optimistic view. But there's always been the dark side of that, going to things like Fritz Lang's Metropolis, where the city is ultimately dehumanizing and people are literally, in that movie, a cog in a machine and you're ground down. Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, things like that. So talk about the modern views, these two different contrasting view of what the city is at this period from the 19th up to the 21st century.
Well, let's start it with industrialization, of course. And you know, Fritz Lang's film is like the kind of the industrial city taken to its sort of horrifying dystopian conclusion. That, you know, cities, you know, much like cities, you know, mega cities in the developing world today grew much faster than their infrastructure could keep up with, very obviously, and had horrific working conditions, horrific living conditions. And there was an idea that, that the city was going to, you know, fall in on itself. This was the Babylon of the modern age, a city that has become so powerful and so big and so monstrous and vice-ridden that they would simply just collapse in on themselves. So you see, what are the responses to that? The suburbanization, you know, that kind of, you know, suburbanization on a mass scale begins in the world's kind of, you know, where the Industrial Revolution begins, which is in England. You get a rejection of cities, that cities have become inverted, whereas the rich used to live in the center of city. Now they're being taken over by these, by a kind of lawless, abused and exploited workforce. They were becoming dangerous and crime and disease ridden. You had to escape from them. What was the escape was to the halfway point between rural and urban, you know, this kind of idea of the Arcadian suburbs. I mean, that idea, you know, completely takes off in America to a much higher degree than in England. But it has its starting point as a reaction against urbanization. What else do you get as a reaction against urbanization? You get this kind of futuristic idea of the answer to kind of urban congestion is to just, is to go higher, is to be like a Chicago or a New York, and to become these futuristic cities. Don't forget that the movie camera and the skyscraper are kind of almost born at the same time, and the movie camera loves it, falls in love with the skyscraper as something that frames a shot, tells you about the future. You can project these futuristic fantasies onto the skyscraper, and it's the backdrop to a lot of movies, especially including even the earliest pioneering movies, are shot and made as Manhattan is kind of going skywards. And there's this idea that cinema is reflecting the future, but it's reflecting a city that's also telling you something about the future, that light and air, health and prosperity will be found at the summit of cities in these kind of great modern ziggurats. Metropolis is a bit like that in the film. It's kind of like the rich and powerful will enjoy this lifestyle, this aerial lifestyle, and will move around by planes, by, you know, by these kind of futuristic technologies. The modernist movement, Le Corbusier, rejects New York as, you know, as a too congested sort of form of skyscrapering, but nonetheless there's this idea that the future is bound up, the mess and confusion and chaos of the industrial city will be undone by a radical rethinking, restructuring of it. So there's the idea of garden cities, the idea of kind of opening cities up with and combining the best of kind of rural and urban civilizations. All of these are reactions against the horror story of the industrial city. I mean, if you, you know, the answer, the, one of the biggest, you know, and most glaring examples of an anti-city city is somewhere like Los Angeles, which was a city that was purposefully set up as a reaction and a rejection of the industrial city that had immiserated the working classes. The working class could get a new start in a city like Los Angeles that was much more decentralized, gave everyone a back garden, a space to breathe, access to nature, undid and zoned and parceled off its functions so that factories and retail and housing were all kept separate from each other. And that was the undoing of the idea of the metropolis as it had developed through history, which was a jumble, a messy jumble of functions that kind of made them exciting places to be in. And they're exciting, those kind of cities are exciting to visit today, where there's a sort of mix, like a Tokyo or an older city that has this urban core where there's lots of functions going on. But the idea of modernity was to sort of separate out these functions and create cities that were much more of a, that spread themselves out, gave people space and air and sanitation to almost engineer your problems away through modern technologies and modern lifestyles, modern conveniences. The motor car, the train, the tram, whatever it happened to be, would kind of rescue you and disperse, you know, cities out into, you know, these kind of much different spatially organized places, whether it's, you know, Le Corbusier and modernism, or whether it's, you know, more sort of capitalist suburbia. they kind of, you know, serve the same ends, to try and sanitize cities and to sort of purge them of the evil that kind of had been injected into them. And so sure, you get, you know, with new technologies of things like the cinema, you get this whole kind of idea of the future being bound up with cities. We still have that, don't we? You know, every time there's a sort of sci-fi movie, unless it's set in space, if it's set on Earth, it is in a, either for good or bad, set in a city, that either our problems have got much, much worse, or they've been purged away simply by amazingly new design. Now, we know that doesn't happen. You know, that a lot of those kind of attempts to create the perfect city, like attempts throughout history from going back to Plato or wherever it was, those attempts to create and design a city that functions perfectly never really works, you know, and it can cause more harm than it cures, because they're kind of the ideas of utopia come from the top down. They tend to break up communities. They often kill a life that comes from a good functioning city. That's, you know, the cure for in the industrial slum, the industrial pollution, was kind of almost worse than the disease in a number of cases, because it caused a kind of spreading out of the city, which is now causing an immense amount of ecological damage. It'll cause a lot of social damage in breaking up communities, of trapping communities in the inner cities, depriving them of access to labor, depriving them of the means to build their own community, which surely is at the heart of how cities function. The, you know, that kind of incremental growth of cities kind of from the grassroots up. So yeah, our kind of, you know, those kind of efforts to sort of create the perfect city, you know, they're still there. We still see them in smart cities, in all kinds of, you know, new technologies that have sort of imposed on cities to make them better. Don't always work. I mean, they're often, you know, by the time the city's built, the technology's moved on, so they're kind of out of date anyway. Yeah, I mean, you find that quite a lot. But also, what satisfies us as people, as city dwellers, is their kind of density, their mix of functions. Sometimes the messiness of cities is kind of what makes them intriguing. And I don't mean mess as in being dirty and unhygienic. I mean mess in the sense that they're kind of you know, a jumble of functions that you can, you know, you can travel about them and get all the things you need in life within a 10 or 15 minute walk. You know, modern cities kind of undid that model, especially they're kind of on the bigger scale, and almost we could be being forced back into that by climate emergency, by rising fuel costs, could force us to live like that again and prevent that kind of outrageous sort of spread of city. But you know, if you understand the history and what people were reacting against, you see why we took that path and why there was this kind of urgency to rebuild. And you know, things like the Blitz in Europe, you know, gave urban planners the chance to impose a new idea of a city. In a lot of cases, it did go spectacularly wrong, but you didn't have to have a bomb city for it in order for it to sort of experience a sort of the massive upheavals of the bulldozer and the cement mixer in the mid 20th century. I mean, that was a case in America as well, of a massive, you know, what it, you know, whatever it was called, of urban regeneration, whatever name was given to it. It was the same purpose of really trying to undo, you know, what was seen as mistakes of the past without allowing them to sort of evolve it to be something better. You know, as I see it, this kind of, it sort of arrested that incremental development and tried to sort of like clear out the detritus of the past. But the damage done to communities was immense, and we're still living through it to a certain extent.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
In the 21st century, the new tension between a nation's cities and its hinterlands is a significant political and cultural divide. And I'd like to close out our discussion by looking at this and seeing if you have examples from history that can address how this divide can be resolved. So in my example, I'm thinking of the United States, but having lived in Hungary and Turkey in cities in both places and having also traveled to rural environments, I see that the tension is somewhat similar in other places. In the United States, since about 1920, that was a tipping point in which more than half the population lived in cities as opposed to rural areas, and that went along with the nation's industrialization. I don't have current numbers, but it's only continued to grow up over the years. And the political tension between cities and rural areas in the United States comes from legislation being crafted in urban areas that don't work well and can actually be stifling in rural areas. And the tension in the other direction could be that people in rural areas are thought of as having outsized political power for the size of their population. So people in urban areas might think, well, we could have universal healthcare and all these things that would benefit our nation if it weren't for these other people that are a disproportionately small part of the population, but has outsized vote, and their living situation is very different from urban areas. So there are many examples I could choose from that I'll just take, let's say, mandates in a growing number of nations and even states that by 2025 or 2030, all vehicles have to be electric. And from a CO2 emission standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. From urban congestion, that makes a lot of sense. So I'm not arguing the validity of the legislation, but the experience is very different. If you have, say, an electric car that travels 300 miles or 400 kilometers per charge, if you live in a city and commute, you know, 30 to 50 miles a day, that's no problem. However, if you live in a rural area, you work for a construction company, you have a truck, and you have to travel several hundred miles per week, that's completely insufficient for your purposes, but a mandate has been given to you that compromises your quality of life. Now, other people could have examples completely in the opposite direction too, so I'm not saying that rural area good, city bad. This is just one perspective. So the point being that there's a tension there between these two areas due to the particularities of the 21st century. So based on your reading of history, can you see ways that this urban-rural division could be resolved?
Well, I mean, it's certainly there, isn't it? I mean, and it's not confined to the United States for sure. You know, Britain has its own kind of version of places getting their own back on the kind of metropolitan elites and metropolitan ways of life, you know, and they will exert that in the ballot box and, you know, in dozens of, you know, many different kind of scenarios and contexts around the world. And it will only get bigger as the world becomes majority urban. I think, you know, there's always been that tension. I think one of the problems, I mean, and I'm slightly moving away from your example, but I'll come back to it. But one of the problems of, especially the context I was writing this book before COVID, was the sort of rise of some, you know, the particular idea of some globalized cities that were leaving other cities in their wake. So it was particular kinds of cities that were thriving, cities that were able to draw in the brightest and the best, draw talent, draw capital, and they were pulling away further and faster than other cities. So it's not just a straightforward urban-rural divide. It's a divide between different types of cities, cities that have failed or prospered in the modern world. Whether after COVID we see a change, a move back to different kinds of cities that offer quality of life. If you can work from home, there'll be a kind of, you know, a sort of repurposing of an increase in the fortunes of cities that had kind of been on their way down, that could be on their way up and could take on a kind of revival as people move away from the bigger cities and move to maybe smaller, medium-sized cities, could be a feature of the next decade or so. Who knows? Yeah, but I mean, that could well be the case, that there's a more equalization of the powers of cities. But the division between cities and rural life for sure exists. And we've got to think very smartly about that, because cities are going to be important in a time of climate change. They're always important economically, but they have a very different character. Cities should take on some of the kind of responsibilities for equalizing, they should take on some of the responsibilities for their hinterlands as well. Something which has been forgotten a lot throughout history. I think the cities that have assumed that's where power and wealth lies and have cut away from their hinterlands in numerous ways and trashed their hinterlands as well. They're places for roads, rubbish dumps, second homes, shopping malls, golf courses, whatever it happens to be, that we've seen the hinterlands as an indefinite resource that the city can plunder. Maybe it'd be a better idea if the cities could limit themselves in some way. Stop sprawling out. I mean, for a lot of the times, the countryside is simply swallowed up by cities. I mean, that's been the story over the last 50 years, and it is also true elsewhere. And there was a line in a novel by Anthony Burgess. I can't remember exactly the novel, but he said, don't move to the city, wait for the city to move to you. And that's sort of become the case, you know, for a lot of people. They get swallowed up in this sort of vortex of continually expanding low-density cities. So I think cities should take some responsibility about limiting their spatial size, but also the wider impacts they have. That's in terms of social and ecological and economic things, but also, yeah, in terms of regulations. That cities have particular kinds of needs, but so do the countryside. Maybe we go back to the sort of the idea I was talking about before of the kind of the medieval European city state, where cities do have this kind of autonomy, but their writ runs as far as their whatever the modern version of the city wall is, the ring road or the outer suburbia, whatever that line is demarcated. That, you know, that that we have fundamentally different lifestyles, and urban life does have a different quality. And you can only sort of see that by kind of recognizing that difference, because cities, you know, let's face it, they're not for everybody. You know, I've said before, you know, earlier, that a lot of people innately reject the cities. Other people flock to it. People go to cities at different times in their life cycles. We shouldn't, you know, the hinterlands have become the dumping grounds for cities' problems. And I think that's a big, big problem. I think cities need to think a bit more smartly about the impact they have beyond their kind of areas. But it's, you know, you're right. It is a historical problem. I think, yeah, cities do sort of suck in this, you know, have this power that they kind of project and are able to exert. But, you know, oftentimes, you know, other people who have a voice get their revenge. It's happened plenty of times through history. So cities should be careful about sort of preserving what's distinctive about them, but also preserving about what's distinctive, and ending this kind of blurring line between city and countryside, which is becoming a feature of the 20th century, I think, this kind of end of a kind of sharp division lines between city and countryside. Yeah, bring back those divisions, maybe.
Absolutely. Well, this is an expansive conversation, and there are many cities we couldn't get to, which you cover in your book, such as London, Belle Epoque France, 21st century Seattle or Shanghai. For listeners who want to get into those stories and many more, the name of your book is Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention. Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.